Welcome one and all to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I am Ray Powell. I'm the former military officer. He is Jim Caruso. He's the former diplomat. Jim, how are you?
I'm very well, Ray. How are you in old California today?
It is finally that the heat wave is over. We're finally much back in the kind of weather we like here in the Bay Area. Our guest today, who I believe is also here in the Bay Area, is Frank Lavin, who has a rich and multifaceted experience in our topic today, which is all about the question of whether the U.S. and like-minded countries should be economically decoupling with China. Frank has served in a variety of senior government and business roles as Undersecretary of International Trade at the U.S. Department of Commerce. He was also the U.S. Ambassador to Singapore. On the private sector side, he's held senior finance and management positions in a number of very well-known multinational firms working in Asia. Oh, and besides his MBA from the Wharton School, he also has a master's degree in Mandarin. I'm starting to feel very inadequate. And closer to my heart, he's also been an officer in the U.S. Naval Reserve. Frank is the founder and CEO of Export Now, a country that specializes in conducting e-commerce with China. So, Frank, given China's recent turn toward a more aggressive and authoritarian policies, and combined with the experience of navigating the severe supply chain disruptions during the COVID-19 pandemic, many people are advocating a strategy of economic decoupling with China. So, Frank Lavin, what is decoupling, and why should we care about whether we pursue these policies?
I think the decoupling argument, and Ray, thanks for having me on. Jim, good to see you again. Thank you for this conversation. Look, I think the decoupling argument is along these lines, that China is more or less a hostile power, or at least it's undertaking policies and activities in Asia that are at times inimical to U.S. interests. So it is not in U.S. interest for China's economy to continue to perform or outperform, and it's foolish or ill-advised for U.S. companies to invest or spend time or make efforts in that environment. And that's sort of the decoupling argument, the anti-China argument, that these fellows aren't our friends, so let's just have as little to do with them as possible, and we might be inadvertently bolstering their economy by participating in it.
All right, Frank. So that's the pro-decoupling argument. What's the anti-decoupling argument?
The anti-decoupling argument is saying, in general, businesses should undertake business decisions for business reasons, that in general, the beneficiary of U.S. business activity is going to be the United States. And if you start arbitrarily cutting off and saying, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't respect women's rights and other countries have all sorts of flaws and problems, if you start doing that, what you're really doing is impeding U.S. Global competitiveness, U.S. exports, U.S. economy. And so be careful about injecting political philosophy into business decisions. That's sort of a general laissez-faire globalist argument I just articulated.
And as long as we're sort of going through the basic laydown of the arguments, there's also recently been a different term introduced, and really sort of around the COVID time, this idea of, well, okay, maybe we're not into full decoupling, but we are certainly interested in de-risking. What is de-risking, and is it substantially different than decoupling?
Yeah, and let me say this. We just went through sort of what's the argument for decoupling, what's the argument against decoupling, and I'd say, look, there's a spectrum there. There's a spectrum because I think even the people who say it's in U.S. interest for U.S. business to continue to be involved in China would willingly accept to say, yeah, but there are a lot of tech industries or dual-use technologies or pure military application activity that really we shouldn't allow. So even if you don't mind selling toothpaste into China, or you don't mind Starbucks being in China, you're saying, yeah, but there's a heck of a lot of difference between toothpaste and a jet engine. So let's have at least some ability to discern what might make sense or be allowable and what might not make sense. And to that point, Ray, is the point you just made about de-risking, to say even if you want to undertake business activity in China, you've got to admit that there's a greater risk, a greater prospect of the unknown in China than there are in other markets. There's greater volatility. There's greater prospect of political sanctions, greater prospect of tariffs for other disruptions. So you need to be thoughtful about what you're doing in that market, even if on the surface it's attractive for business decisions. If there's going to be a tariff war unfolding in the next few years, you might find yourself full of regret that you made that kind of investment or commitment. So why don't you think about balancing off a potential upside, a potential benefits of involvement in that market with also potential costs and potential risks. So de-risking says maybe we have to index up China on that risk calculus a bit because there's been a deterioration in the political relationship. Both sides have shown an appetite or propensity for injecting tariffs or other kind of costs of doing business. And what might have been appealing in the abstract and sort of that golden moment of Chinese liberalization might not be as appealing at present because there's a reasonable chance in the near term you're going to see some disruption in the business operating environment.
So part of the de-risking seems to be American companies that were dependent on production in China are now doing more production outside of China, especially in Southeast Asia and Mexico. And meanwhile, Chinese companies are doing more production in those same countries to avoid U.S. tariffs and barriers. So is that what de-risking and decoupling is going to look like?
Yeah, I think it's multifaceted, Jim, and I think you put your fingers on an important element of that. There's an element of de-risking, which is just called concentration risk, where, for example, historically, Nike had the bulk of its sourcing for shoe production in China because it was the best place. If you ignore the political calculation, China was the best locale for your shoe production. But they came to a conclusion over the last few years to say it is a mistake for us, it's a mistake for us as Nike, to have more than 50% of our production in any one country because there might be a disruption, there might be some kind of a problem. So even if Vietnam or Bangladesh or Indonesia is maybe less efficient than China, it still makes sense for us to make some investments in those markets so our entire production chain, our entire supply chain isn't disrupted on the back of some kind of odd China issue. So I think that makes a lot of sense. By the way, from a policy perspective, that logic was a big part of the TPP argument, the Trans-Pacific Policy argument, Trans-Pacific Partnership argument, I should say, which was to liberalize U.S. trade with other trading partners in Asia. It was sort of an everybody but China argument to say, if you want to see U.S. companies rebalance their activity in Asia, make the other markets marginally more attractive, and you're going to see marginally more activity. All right. So that was a very, I thought, useful way of inducing more of a balance in trade activity. But that fell apart because of U.S. domestic politics, U.S. protectionism.
So, you know, let's go back a little ways because you've been involved in this space for a long time and you have seen a lot go by. And you know, oftentimes when we periodize our relationship with China, 2001 is a real inflection point because of China's accession into the WTO. And many, many people will point to that and say, boy, was that a mistake. We gave away the keys to the castle and we didn't care what happened once the thief was inside. How do you look back at the WTO session and how was that decision made? And do you think it was a mistake?
I don't think it was a mistake, even though recognizing that many other major trading partners, including the U.S., liberalized more steadily and cumulatively more significantly than China. China has, for decades, has lagged in liberalization, although it has liberalized, right? But our hope was that they would pick up the pace and sort of move to the front ranks. They've never had that appetite. Nonetheless, it's useful to do business with as many people who want to do business, even if they're going to remain somewhat protected and state-directed and less excited about international business than Americans were or Europe was or Australia or other trading partners were. Let me give you one or two examples. The WTO requires that any tariff charge or any barrier to trade that is enforced must be promulgated. It must be written. It must be filed in Geneva. It must be published, right? And you'd say, well, that stands to reason. It's sort of like saying on the speed limit, you have to have a posted speed limit. You can't just go up to a car and say you're breaking the speed limit when you say there's no posted speed limit. So that's a WTO rule. And you say, boy, that's kind of self-evident. But China, prior to the WTO, never adhered to that. So you would literally show up in the port in Shanghai and you'd say, I've got my products here. And they'd say, well, 30% tariff. And you'd say, well, yeah, well, 2 weeks ago it was 20%. The guy said, what can I tell you? It's 30% today. And you say, well, can you show me where that's written down? They say, I can't. It's classified. So I've got my rules. I wrote them. I apply them as I see fit. There's no posted speed limit. I'm going to do whatever I want, however I want. I'll give you another WTO rule that we benefited from with their accession. WTO says, as a member of the WTO, there are national level tariffs that are applied and enforced and for every other member. Meaning before China was the WTO, not only could you have tariffs change week to week, you'd have them change port to port. You'd say, I'm bringing in products into Guangzhou and I'm bringing in products to Shanghai, the exact same product, and you're giving me two different tariffs. And the port officials say, what can we tell you? What can we tell you, fellas? That's the way it works. That's your problem, not mine. So you had extraordinary lack of predictability, lack of transparency, lack of consistency the WTO requires they undertake. So that in itself was an enormous boon to U.S. exporters, U.S. businesses, and other exporters as well.
Unfortunately, though, Frank, there were a lot of non-tariff barriers that China made use of.
Sure.
Suddenly claiming sanitary, phytosanitary restrictions on imports or requiring joint ventures for certain things. Currency manipulation has been accused. All these other things, which the critics of the WTO accession say, it didn't do anything for us, even as we opened up our markets.
Yeah. But I think that's a fair criticism. I mean, China's been ambivalent about openness. I mean, U.S. has got some ambivalence, but in general, until the last few years, the dominant view of U.S. was if you liberalize and if you open, your economy is going to benefit. Indeed, we had enormous boom. China's never had that strong of a consensus. So it moved, but it moved in a very incremental and grudgingly pace, as you indicate, and there are areas where they just didn't move at all. But here's my view. Companies that build those barriers or maintain those barriers, first and foremost, hurt themselves. Secondly, they hurt their trading partners, right? But every country decides for itself, do you want to participate in the world economy or not? And there's always going to be laggards, and there's always going to be people who are more of an appetite. So the U.S. view, until recent years, U.S. view said, we understand that. Our goal in life is not to convince the laggards that they're wrong. Our goal in life is to let's find who wants to work with us, who wants to dance with us, and let's dance with them. So let's find the countries in this world, the top 25%, who want to be rules-based, have an appetite for liberalization, and let's find a way to work with them. And we'll benefit from that. So we'll benefit from a free trade agreement with Australia. We'll benefit from a free trade agreement with Central America. We'll benefit from NAFTA. We'll benefit from Israel. So all the countries that have an appetite for working with us, we'll work with them. And indeed, that's been an enormous boon for the U.S. economy. So those countries, 20-some free trade agreements in the last 30 years we put together, that only represents something like 7 or 9% of global GDP, but it represents about 40% of U.S. trade policy. So the folks who do want to work with us, let's work more with us. So I think the mistake we made was to take our foot off the gas pedal. And the mistake we made is say, let's have our trade policy and our trade appetite defined by the laggards. Let's look at the person in this room who has the least appetite for working with us, and let's go get in an argument with them. So sort of like you go to the office Christmas party, 100 people in the room, and 30 of them you get along with really well. You say, well, I don't want to spend time with those 30 people. I want to find the one guy in the room who I dislike the most, and I want to spend the entire Christmas party yelling at that one person. That's the most important thing I can do.
So, is that the U.S. government that made that decision, or was that U.S. business saw the billion plus people in China and said, "There's a huge market that over there. We need to be first in the pool."
Yeah. Made which decision? Sorry,
the decision to spend all our time talking to China instead of the other markets.
Well, by the way, I think there's a domestic political argument for being unhappy with China, because China, as Jim just articulated, China is a bad actor in many respects. So I wouldn't completely ignore that fact, but I wouldn't let that be the central organizing principle in U.S. trade policy. I think, like a lot of elements of public policy, the goal of public policy, in this case trade policy, is how far can we go? What kind of good news can we create for the United States? Where can we help the U.S. economy, U.S. businesses, U.S. workers do better? And you do that by finding like-minded nations. If you say, I'm only interested in domestic political payoff, then you're saying, where's the greatest amount of friction and ill will, and how do I build my trade policy on that friction and ill will? That's focusing everything on China. So I think there's always been somewhat of a domestic political temptation to have some focus on that. But I would keep that in check. I'd say, how much of your trade policy is carrot-based and how much of your trade policy is stick-based? Well, for the last 5 years, it's been about 100% stick based. It's saying the whole point of trade policy is to make a list of what we're unhappy about and to yell at people we're unhappy with. And that's all we're going to do in trade policy is be unhappy.
You know, Frank, when I was doing trade policy, I used to talk to domestic opponents of FTAs, free trade agreements, and say, and they always say, it's unfair. Trading with those countries is unfair. They cheat. They have higher barriers. And I would argue, yes, that's why we do the agreement to take down their barriers so that they're no higher than ours and take a level playing field. But that argument seems to have no traction at all now. No one wants a free trade agreement in the U.S. How do we get to this point?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, the collapse, especially when you say, look at what's happened in the U.S. economy over the last 40 or 50 years, the extraordinary growth in the U.S. and how we've outpaced Europe. And I don't mean like 10% more affluent, but I mean like 50% more affluent. I think they said if the U.K. were a state in the United States, it would be like number 49 or number 50 in terms of per capita income. So U.S. has just over the last few decades really outpaced the world in terms of what we've done. And a part of that is because of this openness, right? But you're absolutely right. It engenders a political response and ill will. And there's always a grievance feeling. I would say this is what I see as the great American strength, not just in business terms, but sort of culturally. Americans will say a good idea can come from any place. A good idea can come from any place in this world. And if we are smart about it, we will capture that good idea. We'll make use of that good idea. We'll adapt that good idea. We'll even improve that good idea, or we'll use that good idea to compete against the next good idea. So if we're smart about it, we have an open economy that's open to ideas, open to technology, open to improvements. So if a guy named Rudolph says, I've got a better idea for an engine that is better than your current engines, and it'll get you better transportation and cheaper food and better distribution and better transportation network, will we use it or not? Now, if you're a pure protectionist, you say, boy, that wasn't invented here, so how good an idea can be? If you're open, you say, Rudolph, by the way, his last name is Diesel. Rudolph Diesel actually has a really good idea. We ought to make use of his idea, right? And we shouldn't be so nationalistic or so insecure or so afraid of ideas that we say, we hate diesel engines. We say, we'll take your diesel engine and we'll make good use of it. We'll build a better diesel engine and we'll transform our trucking industry by using your diesel engine. Now, that was historically the way Americans would look at issues and problems. That's really faded a lot, though, Jim. I'm with you. I think in the last 5 or 10 years, there's really been a fatigue factor or dismay or a view of saying, if you've got a good idea, I don't want it. If you have a good idea, you're trying to cheat me or hurt me or do something bad to me, and I should resent your good idea instead of using your good idea.
Well, back to China, though, I mean, in the case of cheating, is it not a fact that China does cheat, right? I mean, they cheat in a number of ways, you know, whether we talk about intellectual property theft, whether we talk about protectionism or subsidies, you know, these kinds of things. And if you agree that they do cheat, is that a failure of policy or is it, you know, or enforcement, or is it just the fact that we're never going to be able to stem the flow? There's always going to be some, you know, way that they can exploit the holes in our system.
I think they do cheat. And sometimes we use cheating sort of an elastic term. Sometimes it's literally intellectual property theft, breaking the law to steal something. Sometimes cheating is government subsidy. Sometimes those are legal. Sometimes they're not. But we do also have anti-dumping, countervailing duty procedures in the U.S. to push back against that, technically not cheating, but we'd say non-standard business practice, whatever you want to call it. But I guess my point is, look, there's going to be a bad actor out there in the world doing something bad, and you need to have defensive mechanisms against that, those particular bad behavior. But the single best way to deal with bad news is to generate good news. And if you say, my goal is to spend my life litigating bad news, that is 100% defensive strategy, 100% stick strategy, no carrot. So I'd say we definitely should push back against bad news, push back against cheating. But why don't we come up with an affirmative strategy for improving trade in any event? For example, to put all this together, China's got this massive EV program going, electric vehicle program, where they have the least expensive large-scale EV car in the world. So it's a considerable challenge or even a threat, you could say, to the U.S. and to Europe. I would say, boy, why don't we have a U.S.-Europe EV pact where we have free trade electric vehicles so both Europe and the U.S. get advantages of free trade in electric vehicles, get advantages of scale. Neither of us are really competing on price, competing on labor cost. We're both competing in our own markets, but we want access to the other markets as well. Why don't we get that going? And we'll at least have some defensive mechanisms to push back against China's strength and China's sometimes predatory practices.
So the counter argument you were saying is what we hear from a certain presidential candidate who is calls himself Mr. Tariff Man and never met a tariff he didn't like. Can you talk about what the impact would be on U.S. exporters and our trading partners?
Yeah, to my mind, it's astonishing, Jim, to hear somebody argue for tariffs just on the basis, on a philosophical basis, the tariffs are good. You know, I'm old enough to remember the early days of anti-smoking campaign where the American Cancer Society talked about smoking and the harm it does. And the other fellows, the American Tobacco Institute, always had one doctor out there, one medical doctor said, actually, there's no proof that smoking is bad for you. And you always wondered, whatever happened to that doctor? Whatever happened to that one guy who said smoking is okay? Well, I guess he is now the trade advisor to Donald Trump. He's now the one guy on this planet who says, I guess you don't have to worry about tariffs. Look, tariffs raise the cost of doing business. They raise the cost of everything. They raise the cost of energy. They raise the cost of medical supplies, medical technology. They raise the cost of industrial inputs. Something like, I'll get these numbers off, but something like 30% of our industrial imports are assembly into exports for the U.S., meaning you're buying something to fit into something else so that you can sell it again, right? But why not take source the least expensive imports you can, and that'll help your exports. I'll give you, you know, the textbook example here. You've got two car companies in the United States. Each of them employ 100,000 people. One of them says, I'm only going to source from America. I'm just proud to be American. I'm going to play into this sort of nationalism, and I'm going to be afraid of ideas. We're only going to source from America, and I'm going to employ all 100,000 people. The other fellow says, look, I'm going to source global best practices. If somebody has better quality, better technology, better environmental, better safety, whatever, I'm going to source the best in the world, and I will end up with the best car in the world. And so you'd say initially that 100,000 drops to 80,000 because he's sourcing 20% around the world. But within a few years, that 80,000 goes back up to 100,000 because he's exporting. He's globally competitive. Within a few years, it goes over 100,000. So the point is that of those two auto companies, the person who employ the most Americans is the person who imports, who sources from any place in the world because he's got a world quality car. The person who says, I only want to source from America is ignoring technology or ideas from around the world, and he's never going to be able to export and never going to be able to create jobs from being global best practices. So you are sort of cheating yourself, if you will, by saying, I never want to import. We can call that the hubcaps forever school of business, that you said, I'm really proud we're making hubcaps. Not only am I proud making hubcaps, but our children are all going to make hubcaps and their children as well. And in perpetuity, Americans will always make hubcaps. Nobody ever gets a raise. Nobody ever has a better life. Nobody ever moves up the value chain. And we can deny the rest of the world exists. And we can be very, very proud that we're always going to make hubcaps. So that is that strategy in short.
For our Gen Z audience, hubcaps used to be these things. Never mind. Let's look a little about, I mean, you've spent some time in the national security space, Frank. Obviously, from a national security perspective, we look at a different set of issues that you know, the rise of China and the trade policies we've pursued. And some in this space would say, hey, look, we basically, by bringing China into the free trade community, we made them rich, and they are now using that wealth to build up the world's largest navy, to put our position in Asia at risk, to potentially take over Taiwan and the South China Sea. Is there merit to that argument?
Yeah, by the way, I think it's a consideration, but the counter argument is, how many North Koreas do you want? So that was your choice, a middle income or near middle income China or the world's largest North Korea. That was your choice. It wasn't a choice between Thomas Jefferson and Chiang Kai-shek. It was you're either going to have a backwards, impoverished China, brimming with hostility, but with a fair amount of lethality, or you're going to have a approaching middle income China, was still with all sorts of problems and with greater military potency, but also some avenues of engagement.
Right, Frank,
by the way, this goes back to the original Kissinger Nixon outreach, doesn't it? To say, should China always be sequestered? Should China always be isolated from the world? And are we better off with an isolated China? And of course, the original logic of engagement wasn't the sort of, you know, we're going to make them friends if we see, it wasn't that kind of discussion. It was simply the Sino-Soviet split to say there's clearly problems between Moscow and Beijing. We should cultivate that. And we shouldn't let China and the Soviet Union collaborate. So we've got to engage China, if no other reason, to give Mao an alternative to Brezhnev.
Well, I'm pushing back a little bit because it feels a little bit like a false dilemma, right? You know, you either get what we have now, or we get, you know, a Maoist super state, you know, rogue regime firing off nuclear weapons into the sea. So the North Korea thing feels a little overdone to me. Isn't there somewhere in between there that we could have ended up?
Yeah, well, did we get it right or did we get it wrong, or in what ways do we get it right or wrong? I think you almost have to look 30 years from now, look backwards. For example, Ray, we could have a situation where Xi Jinping leaves office in the next few years and he's replaced by someone who's less doctrinaire, someone who says, you know what, we kind of had a good thing going under Zhu Rongji. We kind of had a better setup. We were not quite as adversarial. We're not quite as predatory. We had better relations with other countries. And why don't we dial down some of our rhetoric and some of our international behavior? But if that takes place 3 or 4 years from now, you'd say, well, I guess engagement has some benefits. Maybe we went down the right path. I'll say this. So I would say it's not so much their middle income status that has made them a challenge. It's really Xi Jinping himself has said he believes there's more to gain, more for China to benefit itself by being more adversarial to the West than by integrating itself into this sort of global system. By the way, in some respects, it's not that different than Putin's analysis, right? And Putin is clumsier and more violent, you could say, but Putin also made a decision after a fair amount of engagement with Russia to say, you know, it's not worth it. I'm better off doing a smash and grab in Ukraine than being friends with you folks.
So you've been dealing with China for a very long time and know the people there well. How has Xi's policies affected small, medium businesses that you deal with in China? Are they still able to operate like they were before? Can they be entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I think in a political cultural sense, Jim, there's widespread dismay with Xi Jinping in China that he is a heavy-handed person, he's an intrusive person, and he's got this cult of personality going where you literally have his name and photo on the front page of the paper regularly. His quotations are used in the college entrance exams that, you know, discuss his speeches and so forth. So it's disheartening for a lot of middle-income Chinese to see this kind of retrogression when it comes to civil liberties and personal liberties and so forth. I think the business operating environment is okay, but the shine is off. The shine is off the view that we're in a period of open-ended outperformance with growth, so we can just bet on a good future next year. And you had, like U.S. businesses, you had Chinese businesses over-indexing on growth. Every day is going to be a sunny day. There's no sense planning for bad weather. Now they've had 4 or 5 years of bad weather. Economic tapering and COVID was quite a shock. COVID was because they really took a very theocratic view towards COVID. I mean, they really took a religious fundamentalist view. We're really going to be brutal on this. And by being sort of as tough as we can be, we're going to get through it. And it wasn't true. So you really have a violation of the social contract. I think I'd make this comment about dictatorships in general. There's sort of an unspoken social contract, which says we will let you, the general population, we will let you have increasing personal space to live life on your terms. You may not criticize us or challenge us or come after us. But you do what you want in your personal space. You want to open a restaurant? Go do it. You want to study French? Go do it. You want to go to France? Go do it. You want to form a rock group? Play guitar? Go do it. We don't care what you do, but we're running the show and don't come after us. And our commitment to you is the economy is going to outperform. Your life is going to get better. you're going to have more money, more opportunity, more disposable income than you've ever had in your life. That's our commitment to you. You say, well, you know what? There's some value in that kind of social contract. But boy, it got shattered during COVID. Now they're saying, now we're going to be more intrusive in your political, your personal space. So it's not just that you have no economic, you know, golden prospects in front of you, but now you have less scope for personal behavior as well. So you say, boy, this is a little disheartening, isn't it? It's the first extended period of bad weather in China in decades. So for anybody, you know, younger than 50, this is sort of the worst moment in their lives, that they've never had this kind of protracted period of really slow economy and a more intrusive and, say, repressive government.
So given that, and given this experience that they've had recently with the downturn in the economy, I've seen it seemed like all of the momentum in China was toward actually decoupling with the West, right? That there was an increasingly authoritarian state with this techno-surveillance state and, you know, trying to promote its own domestic market or at least friendly markets. And now they are faced with, you know, a worsening debt crisis and sort of economic sluggishness. Do you see a potential that they would begin to turn the dial back toward liberalizing their economy again?
By the way, that's what they ought to do. That's what they, and I got to tell you, this is sort of painful for me because this is my preaching to China. So we had a Chinese delegation in here in San Francisco last year for APEC. So we had all these, I'm not in government anymore. So you have these side conversations. So you get this kind of plaintive solicitation from the Chinese side. Well, what should we do? Everybody kind of hates us now. Everybody's mad at us. What should we do? We said, well, yeah, everybody's kind of mad at you. You're right. I said, well, why don't you do something significant, somewhat symbolic, but somewhat real? Why don't you pick one economic sector like auto parts and just declare zero tariffs on auto parts, and you're open for something that would kind of send a signal to the markets that you actually haven't moved away from liberalization. You're still willing to embrace it. You still believe in, you know, trying to trade fairly. They just can't. There's so much inertia and rigidity in that system that it's very, very tough for them to do anything. And it's a top-down system. So bad news doesn't flow up the way it might. Look, U.S. has got a fair amount of rigidity in it too, but at least there's avenues for expressing yourself and making a point. And over time, you know, the government sort of figures things out occasionally. But boy, it is very, very tough with the Chinese. So I don't think there's a corrective mechanism in the Chinese system. I think it just gets worse. So I think we're going to have more intrusive industrial policy. I think we're going to have more economic tapering. I think we're going to have ongoing international friction. The easiest thing in the world, Ray, you and I were kind of chatting about this the other day. The easiest thing in the world for them to be to say, why are you guys so persistently aggressive vis-a-vis the Philippines? Why are you doing this? Who are you helping? How does this help China at all? Why don't you just dial that back a bit? You don't even have to change your international claim. You can say whatever you want, but why are you making this physical? Why are you going and harassing these Philippine ships? That doesn't help you at all, but you can't. They don't have a corrective mechanism in the U.S. So in China, I should say, sorry. So it is very, very tough for them to pull back or withdraw. It looks like a sign of weakness.
Well, that's not a pretty picture. So they have a slowing economy, not going to get better. We have at least one highly protectionist candidate running for president. We have a Europe that seems to be slowing down. Tell me something positive.
Well, yeah, Jim, you make me want to go have a beer right now. But we're at a period, I guess, of international drift. And I think my worry for the United States is there's a domestic political constituency that respects friction and sees friction in itself as a sign of strength. But I would say, boy, that there's a real cost to that. You can't manage by friction any more than you can drive your car by using the horn. And the real strength of the United States is our ability to collaborate, that we are willing to establish friendships and alliances and find common ground with like-minded nations. And that has been an enormous source of international leadership in the Cold War and post-Cold War era. And I would encourage whoever the next president is, get back to those basics and lead through collaborative conversations.
So back to the national security question, because this has real implications for, frankly, your business and for U.S. business. Should things turn kinetic, as we say, in the Indo-Pacific? Should there be a cross-strait invasion? Should there be a flare-up in the South China Sea? We could see decoupling all of a sudden become the law of the land in a very severe way. Do businesses worry about the geopolitical risk, about what could happen in the next several years in the Indo-Pacific?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's very market segment determined, Ray, meaning at one end of the spectrum, you have very capital intensive activities, a chemical processing plant that might cost several hundred million dollars to build, might take several years to build, and might have a 20 or 30 year life. And they say it's a 30 year life, but we don't really even start making money back till after year 10 or something like that. You say, boy, those kind of projects have, I think, huge question marks on them now, that people have very little appetite for undertaking those kind of projects. Or if they do, this is why they would prefer a joint venture or some other kind of entity, where they say, I don't want to necessarily make a 10-year bet like that. At the other end of the spectrum are sort of consumer goods or items that have no real time horizon to them, and what you sometimes call in the trade a depot business, meaning the product comes off the ship and is sold and the money's remitted, and it's not capital intensive. There's not a long dated product. That's back to the toothpaste example. Or you might put Starbucks in the same case, although Starbucks, you have to build out stores and put some investment there, but it's not a chemical processing plant. So I think there's still appetite in that segment of saying consumer goods, apparel, food and beverage, entertainment, hospitality, that is easier to say yes to. And the capital intensive activities, if you're Ford, do you put in a $500 million to build out an assembly line in China? I think that's a heck of a bet you're making, that the market's going to hold up, that there's not going to be political disruption, that these new Chinese EVs aren't going to just claw away 20% of what you're currently selling. So I think if you're Ford, you say, you know what, I don't have the appetite for that $500 million check. If you're Procter & Gamble, you might say, absolutely, go for it. We're selling toothpaste. We love it. And keep selling more toothpaste.
So I'm just getting back to trade and the philosophy. You know, you talk about WTO helping reduce tariffs, but a big problem in our trade situation now is the institutions of WTO failed. They weren't able to litigate disputes on a timely basis and what was seen as a fair basis. And so the institution lost confidence from basically all the parties. Now the U.S. is basically saying, we're not going to pay any attention. Without a arbitrator, can trade go back to the way it was?
Yeah, Jim, by the way, first, I think that's a very fair criticism. The WTO is a limited mechanism, and it worked to a certain extent, and it's really faltered in recent years. And the more inclusive it is, the less likely it is to work, for the simple reason the WTO, unlike the World Bank or the IMF or even the UN, there's no Security Council, there's no board of directors, there's no weighted ballot. It is 100% consensus-driven decision-making. So when you had 40-some members of the GATT right after World War II, and they're all kind of Western Europe and Japan, you could kind of get an agreement. Now you've got 150-some members all over the map, and not surprisingly, there's outliers, and they drive more power by being obstructionist than by being collaborative. So you've got a perverse incentives in play. So I would have limited faith in the likelihood of WTO playing a constructive role. But that, to my mind, that backs us into saying, well, then the U.S. can lead. The U.S. can do a free trade agreement with Europe, which would be enormously helpful to all parties. It could look for other like-minded nations and do free trade agreements. It could do sectoral agreements. I mentioned like electric vehicles a minute ago. But I would just tell American leadership, don't stand still. China is not standing still. The world's not standing still. So if you're view of how to help America, sort of fortress America, stand still, build high walls, watch out. That is going to hurt the U.S. economy, hurt U.S. workers. So it's going to require somebody in D.C. to show some leadership. And maybe we do sectoral free trade in pharmaceutical products or medical technology, where you'd say, I think you'd be able to get a majority support for that, because it's people's personal health. So maybe you start in some small areas and move from that. But right now, we have stood still to our detriment, and China is moving.
All right. Well, on that happy note, Frank Levin, thank you for joining us. This has been really educational for me as a former military officer. This is not my background, so this has been really helpful for me. But you know, if we want to keep up with you and what you have to say on these kinds of things, how should people follow your work?
I'd be delighted. I'm on LinkedIn and on Twitter, and my handle is, in one word, Hello Frank Levin. So just look at Hello Frank Levin. I'd be delighted to connect, follow up, answer questions. Thank you so much. And thank you guys for having me on. It's fun. It's fun, and it's exciting to talk trade. And my wife won't listen to me when I talk trade. My kids leave the room when I talk trade. So it's great to have two friends on where we can talk trade issues. Thank you so much.
Well, Jim really loves it when you talk trade, and I do the best I can.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks. Take care. So, Jim, I have to say that was really interesting for me. I am not sure how much Frank and I are on the same page. I think in the world that we like to, you know, sort of in the China policy world, we often will talk about panda huggers versus dragon slayers. Coming from the security side of things, I probably tend to fall a little more in the latter category. Well, Frank, maybe a little in the former, but of course, those are just too easy as categories, right? You know, those are just terms of fun more than of art.
Well, Frank's an old school, laissez-faire, free market guy, and you know, doing business with China has been very lucrative for lots of folks for many years. You know, it's a huge market, and companies were willing to knowingly have their IP stolen to get access to the market. They saw it as a cost of doing business. Now,
is that a
long-term plan?
You and I both worked for a little while for the same guy, ambassador in Australia, who used to represent some of these companies. And he liked to say that some of them really regret having gone in, because in the end, what ended up happening was not only did they have their IP stolen, but then essentially their competitor was built right in front of them, and then they were sort of pushed out of the market.
Absolutely. So, but I think free trade in general has now got a bad name in the U.S., China or no China. Right. And part of it is obviously we've lost industries like steel making, by and large, because of trade. Now, this was foreseen as happening, and we had something called trade adjustment assistance into the law, which was supposed to help workers who lost their jobs because of these new trade agreements. Unfortunately, it was never fully funded. Unions never took advantage of it. They wanted to keep the old jobs, and it all fell apart. And as a result, we have a lot of angry people who have lost jobs, and companies have lost income because of free trade, even as the overall economy has benefited, as Frank said.
Yeah,
but the answer can't be just to run and hide.
No, and you know, of course, those of us who are involved in the security side of things, Frank brought up the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, for the most part, we were fans, right? Because we wanted to see these relationships with like-minded countries have more than just a security manifestation. We wanted the countries involved to look at the United States and not just see a supplier of arms or a guarantor of security, but to see a lucrative partner with which to do business. And that would be sort of the way to get about de-risking. And so I appreciated that perspective from him. Again, I am not the trade guy. I'm not competent to tell you what the pluses and minuses of TPP are from a trade perspective, but from a national security perspective, it made a whole lot of sense.
It was a security agreement. It would have changed U.S. trade by 0.01%. It was meaningless that way. But as a way to, as Frank said, get countries to work with us instead of China, at least to some degree, and help them de-risk their over-concentration in China, that was a win that we lost.
All right, Jim, it's your turn. There I was. So you tell me a story about where you were.
Okay. So since we're talking about trade, the other part of trade is investment. So I was involved with a company that looked to do some offshore software programming. So we looked around and found a place offshore where we could hire programmers for a lot less. And I was sent off to start up the company. So I get there and, you need phones. Well, I was told, to get a phone, you need to apply to the monopoly telephone company. It's owned by the state. Okay, well, how long would that take me to get a phone? Oh, waiting list now is about 10 years. I said, that may be a little longer than we care to wait. What should I do? You go to your lawyer and you explain you'd like him to facilitate getting the lines.
I see where this is going.
So the lawyer facilitated it. We got the telephone lines in no time at all. Then I went to a travel agency because we were going to do a lot of traveling through the region. And I said, I'd like to negotiate with you discounts for our travel. And the owner of the company said, look, this is what I'll do. I'll give you a 5% kickback on all of the tickets. And I, being a naive young American, said, well, look, can't you just apply that 5% discount to all our company tickets? And he said, what do you think I am? I can't give everyone a discount.
Bribes are 100% okay, but discounts, no, we're against those.
He was a man of principle. So... corruption is actually a huge problem in a lot of countries, and something to remember about the U.S., as difficult as we are sometimes, generally speaking, in our daily lives, we can get licenses and do business without having to resort to that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I know that there are many people who, you know, see certain parts of the U.S. government up close and or the U.S. Business sector up close and see corruption everywhere, but they, in many cases, those people have never seen the pros at corruption, and they are to be found in most cases off our shores.
It's certainly been my experience.
All right. Well, Jim, this has been a great one. I do want to make sure I continuously give a shout out to our producer, Ian Ellis Jones. Please follow him on X at Ian Ellis Jones. And again, his high quality military and geopolitical graphics are getting lots and lots of attention. If you are listening to us in your ear holes with your earphones and we are an audio podcast only to you, do know that you can look at us if you want to. You go to youtube.com/IP Podcast. You can find lots of all of our content there, including, say, the aforementioned episode 33 with Mark Dallas, when we talked about why should we care if supply chains with China are breaking. You can also look for us on our social media pages on LinkedIn and X. Oh, and by the way, if you're watching us on YouTube, of course, you can find us on the audio podcasts. If you like those, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of those. Finally, we want to say thank you. We do appreciate you. Please keep sending us your questions, whether it be probably the best way to send questions is on our YouTube page. And thanks again for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.